We'll now move to our last talk,
which will be given by Professor Clark Westerhout, who is now director of the Naval Observatory. He is different from our other speakers in that he's the only one to come into radio astronomy from astronomy. And this happened at Leiden Observatory, which, led by Professor Oort, had a very early interest in radio astronomy, but more from a classical side than the radio engineering side of which we've seen so much this morning. During the 1950s, he worked on 21 centimeter surveys of the Milky Way using the 7.5 meter Wurzburg antenna that I'm sure we'll be hearing about. And I'd like to say that these Wurzburgs, of which Professor Solomonovich also showed one, were used by all of the non-German countries as a vital part of their early radio astronomy. England, Sweden, France, US, Soviet Union, all had Wurzburgs, which played a vital role in, while the Germans were being prohibited from doing any kind of radio research until the late 1950s. Anyway, and then the 25-meter Duiguelot dish came along, and he concentrated on continuum radiation, and I'm sure we'll be hearing about some of that towards the end of the 1950s. And if we can have the first slide, we'll see him in the characteristic pose with a cigar in his mouth. He's now given that up, but some of us can remember when he used to do that. And here you go, Professor Westerhout.
Thank you, Dr. Sobel. I'd like to start, well, I presume you all realize that that's how I'll start, with the 1944 discussion on radio astronomy held by the Dutch Astronomers Club, which I understand is still a very active organization where all Dutch astronomers get together once or twice a year and discuss current topics. In 1944, in the spring of 1944, the Astrophysical Journal, with Reber's paper and with the Henney and Keenan papers, had penetrated into then occupied Holland, and it was decided to organize a meeting on radio astronomy. Professor Bakker gave a general review on the data and on what radio astronomy was for the uninitiated Dutchman, while Van der Hulst was given the charge of doing some interpretation. Well, interestingly enough, Van der Hulst started by concluding that really, although radio astronomy had been in existence for 13 years after Jansky's discovery, astronomers weren't very interested in it because the data were not good enough. They were too rough and there was no good discussion possible. And that was, I think, part of the general attitude of astronomers in those days. We'll be glad to discuss your data, but the engineers better come up with something good first before we can do anything with it. Van der Hulst also concluded that in any case, the production of radio waves in the interstellar gas, I'm quoting, was such a small portion of the energy budget that purely theoretical consideration of their production would not teach us anything new. That was the introduction to his, well, all the introduction to his famous paper. But after having thus damned radio astronomy from the start, he produced what in essence was the first scholarly paper in the field. And it contained not one, but three predictions which all came true. Expanding on Henney and Keenan's 1940 article on the free emission, he went on and did a whole lot of additional calculations. He noted the uncertainties in the theory. Particularly, he noted that the hot gas is distributed in H2 regions, and therefore very clumpy. And since in the free emission, any squared always sticks up its naughty head, it means that really, unless you know something about the distribution, you can say very little about the overall intensity distribution of the H2 regions. He also made a calculation of the strength of the recombination lines, which was the first time that was done, and concluded that we don't know the Stark broadening effects very well yet, but once we know that, there may be a possibility of investigating H2 regions behind dust clouds, 1944. That's one of the things that I think is forgotten. He drew
the spectrum of the free emission. Because we all know what the spectrum of the free emission looks like. It goes like that, right? I mean, this is the black body radiation. And of course, that showed immediately, he had Reber's observations. Reber's high frequency observation was here. The next frequency observation was here. The next ones were somewhere up here. That's when Reber finally made his first detection at 150, 160 megahertz. But it was clear why Reber didn't observe anything. Jansky's data fitted here. They were about a factor of 10 too high. And van der Hulst kind of discards that. He says it seems possible that this is due to his poorly known directivity. In other words, he was again reluctant to accept new data, but Jansky, of course, saw it was a completely different type of spectrum. Van der Hulst wasn't quite ready to accept it. At the suggestion of Oort, van der Hulst made a very interesting calculation about how at radio wavelengths we can distinguish between an expanding and a static universe, because the spectrum of the radio emission, of course, is entirely different from that of the optical ultraviolet spectra of galaxies. And there was, on the basis of the then existing data, absolutely no doubt from those little back of the envelope calculations that we did not have a static universe, i.e. the Doppler effect is really velocity and not some other effect that has something to do with distance. So that's basically started the field of radio cosmology. And then in half a page, he showed that the spin transition of the 21 centimeter of a neutral hydrogen would produce a spectral line there. And Oort basically had suggested that topic. The task that the graduate student van der Hulst was given, he was a damn good physics student, you see, was what can we do in radio astronomy given spectral lines? Because Oort knew darn well that, of course, the spectral line suddenly opens a wide field everywhere in astronomy and astrophysics. All right, so it was three different subjects: recombination lines, cosmology, and the 21 centimeter line that occur in that classic paper, which was published after the war in 1945. And of course, they started thinking after that about radio astronomy as a means to study the galaxy, which was, of course, Oort's pet project. And in fact, in November 1945, about half a year after the end of World War II, when people had a little bit to eat and they somehow or another got back up from their 85 pounds weight to their 135 or 140 pounds, which is typically Oort's kind of weight. Not mine. He proposed to the government the construction of a 25 meter diameter radio telescope. And in fact, he knew a number of those people from his the war days, and he got several of the government ministers very much interested in that. And as a result, the Dutch government was right from the start interested in the development of that sort of thing as a project. It then took a few years to sort of get organized. I was talking a few days ago with Professor Stumpers, and he remembers that in the late 45, early 46, Professor Minnaert, who was a solar physicist, and he were trying to point a Yagi antenna at the moon and at the sun. But somehow or another, they kept missing the sun. They saw the Milky Way instead. Because at that frequency, of course, the Milky Way was the dominant thing, particularly with the beamwidth of one Yagi antenna. There were a number of different experiments also going on in solar radio physics in those early years by the Dutch Post and Telegraph Services, for the obvious reasons of trying to start predicting the behavior of the ionosphere. In fact, that led to the first worldwide network of continuous observations of the sun during the 24 hours, because the Dutch Post and Telegraph Service set up a station in Suriname and a station in New Guinea, and for about a year and a half watched the sun every day for had continuous records, which I don't think much of that was ever published, but it went into the files of the IGY. In a collaboration between various observatories, the post office department, the Philips physical laboratories, the foundation for radio astronomy was established in 1949, and the post office made available a Würzburg antenna, which was located in the Dutch Post and Telegraph Services transmitting station in Kootwijk, where they had 100,000 watt transmitters within half a kilometer. A very interesting place to do radio astronomy, which Muller rapidly learned. In fact, a young engineer by the name of Ho was appointed in 1948 and worked with Philips factories. He worked with an old receiver, old US receiver from the war years, trying to detect the line, didn't get very far, and in 1950 the whole kit and caboodle burned down. In fact, I found in the minutes how terrible that was, because the total loss of the equipment, including the building, was 8,000 guilders, of which the Honeywell Brown recorder, committee forming the Foundation for Radio Astronomy had agonized for 4 months whether they would spend the 2,500 guilders in American money, which wasn't available in Holland, and they finally decided to buy it. That was the major item of the loss during that fire. The Philips factory and others lost about 600 guilders worth of equipment. Then in December of 1950, Muller, who had just graduated from Delft University, was appointed as the engineer, and on the grand salary of $800 a year, he got married, got himself an apartment in Apeldoorn and a bicycle, and cycled every day to Kootwijk, which was about 3/4 of an hour, and started constructing very rapidly with the help, again, of the Philips factories, where Professor Stumpers, who is, of course, as you all know, one of the vice presidents of IRSI at this time, was extremely instrumental in assisting the work and was very much involved in all these early experiments in getting good equipment. So that then led to the construction of the equipment that finally was used for the 21 centimeter line. In the meantime, Frank Kerr showed you the sort of all sky map with a 17 degree beam made by Bolton and Westfold. Bolton and Westfold visited Leiden in the summer of 1950 and got Professor Oort so excited by their map, and got us all so convinced that that was really the first well-worked-out map, because not only was it a good map, they had made a correction for the effect of their limited beam width, and they had basically taken out the effects of the 17-degree beam. So what we were seeing was really the true distribution of the 100 megahertz radio emission over the sky. And sort of